So there were two main questions. There are like small, small questions. This is one problem. The feedbacks are good. You have questions, but I don't know how to address because sometimes there are many. I don't have time to address all those. If you can personally email me those questions, if you don't mind, I can answer them on emails. Few questions which are like common, like a lot of people had doubts in those, I can discuss those. Like for example, one common doubt was the difference between Heisenberg and Shadid, like a comparison between both the pictures, a few of them had. And then maybe I can also give one very quick example. I don't want to waste a lot of time on Heisenberg picture today, but a very quick example just to give you an idea how it works, okay? And also on the Bloch sphere thing, because some of you don't know what Bloch sphere is. I'm not going to go into the details. That's not what I intend to cover today, but I'll just give you the enough details you require for this course. All right, that sounds good. So I'll cover with these two topics quickly, and then I plan to give you the outline for each lecture before the lectures. I think that's going to help you to foresee what I'm going to talk about next, all right? So I'll just summarize both the pictures here. So in this picture, we talk about state vectors. In that picture, we talk about the operators. But the only observable we have is any observable or the expectation value. So this is a time-dependent expectation value, which is like same for both the pictures. There's no difference. But the difference is how we calculate it. In this picture, we calculate the expectation value by finding the state vectors, which are time-dependent. And in here, the time dependence is taken in. So it's exactly the same. Like the mathematical formulation is just the same. It's how you approach the problem is different, okay? If Hamiltonian is my time independent, just for ease of writing here, but it could be time dependent as well. We saw Dyson series yesterday. And in this case, vectors are evolving. And in this case, and maybe I should write H everywhere and maybe S everywhere just to distinguish between both the approaches. Okay. In here, the basis, they remain fixed. And in here, the basis, they evolve, say, opposite to what you will expect for the short, for the waves to evolve with, wave functions, sorry. And the equation of motion is the Schrodinger equation of motion. Familiar. For Heisenberg picture, the way we approach the problem is not by solving the Heisenberg equation or finding for the state vectors, but instead we solve this equation, which we saw yesterday. Okay, and for those who are looking at it for the first time, you might not get an intuition, like how? Let's say a very, very simple example. Almost everyone who has done Heisenberg picture would have been the first problems you have dealt with is for a free particle. So free particle Hamiltonian is like there's no potential. So this is the Hamiltonian for a free particle. And in short, in your picture, you know how to find it. You just substitute the Hamiltonian and solve for psi, or substitute Hamiltonian and find the time dependence for your psi. In here, what you do is you observe the observables. So after this, it's not the end of the story. You always talk about finding some expectation values of any observable, because you can't observe psi. Even if you solve the problem for a free particle in Schrodinger picture, the observables are this. You'll substitute these psis in here and find these observables. In here, we are directly doing that. So in a way, it's a much easier way. And let's say we talk about two observables, which is the momentum and position. Let's say it's a one-dimensional problem. And the way to approach is just to see the time evolution of these operators, which corresponds to your observable, using this equation of motion. That's all. So all you need to do is find this commutation relation. That gives you a differential equation for your observable. Okay? So let's do it quickly here. And H is, and A, the operator which I'm trying to find the values for, is the X operator. And using commutation relations and everything, if you just simplify it, you'll see that this is zero, right? Which makes sense. If there's a free particle, the momentum shouldn't change. You can do the same thing for use the commutation relations, and you'll end up with a familiar looking equation for your position. And since zero means that Px is constant, which makes sense. It should be a linear motion, right? It's a free particle. That's a very quick example. Where we are going to use this is in the block sphere, which I didn't discuss, and I would like to do that as well, and exactly tell you what tutorial problem we are going to hit with, so that you can have a prior idea of it. So is this thing clear? Can we talk about block spheres now, like real quick? Okay. So is there anything anyone wants to add? I'll be happy to add something which I have missed, but it's just a brief, yeah.
Maybe just that what we've just done in the classical physics course is exactly this.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah. That's a good point to be added. It's the Heisenberg picture is much closer to the classical pictures, because these are the observables which you are seeing, right? So it's much closer to the classical Poisson equation and so on. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. So block sphere is a sphere, and it's usually used to represent any two-level system. But for our course, we are going to represent spins on them, okay? I think at least a couple of times. Spins are also two-level system, like they have two bases. Let's write 0 and 1, like up and down spin. And these bases on the block spheres are represented on the north and south poles, okay? So this, let's say, is 0, this is 1. And let's say I'm working in Z bases, okay? So this is the spin component in Z up and down, okay? What's important to note here is that these bases, which I'm saying, are the bases for the polyspin matrices. So if you find the eigenbasis for this matrix, you should get these, all right? This is something important which we'll use in the tutorials as well. And any spin can be represented in superposition of zeros and ones. We know that. So for example, I can represent a plus spin as these are the usual spins in x and y basis, which we are familiar with, okay? Maybe the notations are something different, which we have used, but they are those. What's important is any point on the surface of the sphere, which are exactly opposite, they have to be orthogonal. So don't confuse them with the rectangular Cartesian coordinate system, okay? It's not that. So these two would be orthogonal, these two would be orthogonal, we know that, would be orthogonal, okay? For convenience, we represent this as the z direction, this as the x, and this as the y, okay? So you can also express them in terms of the spherical coordinates as well, but let's not go into that right now. Any point on the surface of the Bloch sphere can be given by, so any spin, you can say any general spin can be given as a superposition of your basis. Okay? So for example, let's see if I can represent this on my, like where do I represent this on my Bloch sphere? Let's check that. Before that, I need these alphas and betas. And I know that these are probabilities. And by convention, we choose alpha to be e to I some phase vector, cos of theta by 2. And I'll just get into a moment what is theta. And beta as e to I delta. And these phase vectors are just keeping in mind that alpha betas could be complex numbers, right? So we get it could have a different phase. And we write this as phi. And what are these thetas and phis on the Bloch sphere? So theta is the angle with the z-axis. Okay, so theta is this angle here. And it can vary from, theta can be between 0 and pi. So it can take values from like 0 to 1, okay? It's going to rotate like this. And phi is the angle on the xy plane. So it's this angle. It's the plane which is rotating. So it can take values from 0 to 2 pi. So let's see what thetas and phis I need if I want to represent this spin state. So what I need is for plus, yeah, theta should be, what value of theta? I don't want, oh, there's a cos, there's a sign missing. So for 0 plus 1, phi value could be anything. And I need this to be 1. This need to be 1. So I need something like pi, pi by 2. Right? So let's see how it should look on the Bloch sphere. So if I have theta pi by 2, it's like here. I'm trying to represent it on the x. So it's like this rotation, something of that sort. So this is the state plus, and this will be the state minus. So this is angle theta, 90 degree. Okay? I can show you animation to make it look much pleasing, and so on. And these states are the I and the minus I. And what's, again, interesting is that these states are the eigenbasis for your Pauli spin sigma, did I say sigma x? X, sigma y, and sigma z. Okay, So these bases are the eigenbases for these polyspin operators. When we talk about, when in the context of our lectures, when we are talking about evolution, we are trying to look at evolution of these spins. And there are two ways to do that. Either I could use the Schrodinger picture, like let's say I give you a Hamiltonian, a magnetic field, you know the Hamiltonian for a magnetic field. You could see how your spins are going to evolve in time on the Bloch sphere. You could see them rotating, something like that. Equivalent way would be to see how these operators, they evolve with time and use Schrodinger picture. Okay? Yeah.
You represented the cluster, shouldn't that be pi by 2 and 0?
Oh, yes. So theta is equal to 0.
I mean.
Yeah, because you're not taking any rotations. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Because this is theta and this is the phi angle and you're not taking any rotation. It's on the x-axis, so phi should be 0. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Other than that, let me use this part of the board, which is not too visible, but I would like to keep it on the board, is the outline of today's lecture, okay? So what we are going to cover, as suggested by a lot, and I like the idea, is to focus on less topics and have like more discussion on fewer topics, okay? So we are going to do that. We are going to talk about interaction picture today. And we'll find the reason why we study interaction picture, how we do it. So it should involve like some kind of, exactly like Schrodinger and Heisenberg, it should involve some kind of equation of motion. And we'll talk about what equation of motion we are talking about. In Schrodinger equation, it's the equation of motion for your wave function. In Heisenberg, it's the equation of motion for your operators. In here, it's the equation of motion for something else. We'll talk about what, okay? And then we'll see two ways to solve this equation of motion. One would be solving it exactly for the cases where we can do it, and then perturbatively. And when we do this, we'll talk about something called the Fermi-Golden rule as well, okay? So these are the topics I want to cover today, okay? I'll start with the screen because I want to show you this Bloch sphere on GeoGebra and see how angles theta and phi can help you draw any spin on the Bloch sphere, okay? So any questions so far? Sure, okay, great. Can you all just quickly scan for the questions? And you have been asking most of the questions, which is good, but I still see some not interacting much. So if you're still hesitant, you can just scan and ask. Okay. So this is the Bloch sphere I wanted to show, right? So these are the eigenbases 0, 1, the y eigenbases, the x's. And if I just change these thetas and phis, you'll see a different spin being represented on the Bloch sphere. So for example, the state which we just found out was phi 0 and theta 90. Is the one on plus x. Okay. Let's see how one should look like. So one would be given by any phi, but I think theta should be 180 degrees. So exactly opposite, like north and south pole. But I'm free to choose any phi. It won't change, and so on. So Bloch-Sphere helps us to visualize any two particle, like two level system, all right? Okay, so let's get started. So I think we don't need a quick recap, but we did see different approaches. And throughout this quantum theory course, that's our aim, to see different quantum theoretical approaches, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, interaction or Dirac picture today, density metrics, so path integral formulation. So these are different ways of doing the same thing, actually. So that's the purpose of the entire course, to give you a training or just if you're already familiar with all these, just to give you a quick recap of all these different theoretical, quantum theoretical approaches. So again, this is customary. I have done it for all the lectures. For this course, what we'll see is that handling time-dependent potentials is really difficult. Remember yesterday when we had a time-dependent Hamiltonian, we had to use a n-fold integral for it, which is complicated to do. You can do it, but it's tedious to do. So when we are trying to solve time-dependent potentials, it's better to change your perspective. Like, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. So maybe switching your frame of reference or thinking of a different frame of perspective would ease the problem. And that's what the Dirac or the interaction picture is about. So I'll give you a timeline, like how the, let's you start from that part of the board. So let's first define the problem, what we are trying to solve. So the question is this. I have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and I'm assuming, because this approach works well for this assumption, that I can write my time-dependent Hamiltonian as a time-independent part and a time-dependent part. And the time-independent part is H0, for which I know the eigenbasis. So H0 has a well-defined eigenbasis. All right? What I want to do is I want to solve and see how my system evolves with this time-dependent Hamiltonian. So obviously, if this is time dependent, my wave function should be time dependent as well. All right. Suggestions, how can we solve this? We have already done two approaches yesterday, right? How can we solve this? Using the defining the time evolution operator, right? Solving in Schrodinger picture. But then again, we need Dyson series. Okay, let's try to use Heisenberg picture. Always need to solve a commutator, which is time dependent, a commutator for every different time. Complicated, tedious to do. So what we are instead going to do is we are going to solve it by breaking into two parts. Obviously, we can do that. And define a timeline. So there's some timeline, say the very start of time, t naught, some tf, and then way in future. So what this timeline says is that before time t naught, the only potential on the system, let's say, was h naught. Okay. Now at t naught, I switch on my potential, the time dependent one, and my system evolves according to this Hamiltonian. And at TF, I switch it back off. So my system is again under the influence of H0, all right? That's the timeline. So for T is equal to 0, my state of the system is defined by zero, which I know has a good eigenbasis, and I can write it as, right? Between zero and t naught, it should evolve with time, and the evolution should be according to the h naught. So the evolution for this time in between would be right. How about this time? Let's come back to the difficult part later. How about this time? So for time greater than TF, what do you expect? So I can write this as how should I be able to write it? So still it's under the influence of only H naught. There's no time dependence. So how would you be able to write the final psi after I have switched off the potential?
It'll be similar.
I can use the same basis. Yeah, that's the point. Superb. Right? Yes, but I have to attach the time dependence somewhere. So what we usually do is attach the time dependence. And mathematically, it makes sense. It's not like an assumption, because this is your good basis. You should be able to represent your system in terms of this basis at any time, right? Unless you have applied a perturbation which is like really strong and it has changed the system altogether. For example, let's take an example of atom. So throughout the lecture, we'll talk about atoms, okay? That's the standard problem we are going to take. So for atoms, you have atom, you know how to solve the eigenbasis for it, hydrogen, so on. Before the potential is switched off, you can write it as superposition of all these states, apply an electric field, time dependent, switch it off. At the end, you'll still see the system in these orbitals, unless you have applied a very strong electric field that your atom has ionized or something. Then you won't be able to write your system in the same eigenbasis. The eigenbasis would have changed. So I'm assuming the potential is small. All right? So between this time as well, which is like time t naught, so it's safe to say that my system would be...
Sorry.
Yeah.
You absorb the time evolution operator into the CNs, right?
No, we'll keep that.
No.
It's still there. It's still there. Yes, it's still there. Yeah, that's a good observation. It's still there. Okay? So...
But how is it that, like, after we stop adding the time-dependent perturbation, shouldn't we have constant, different constants, but there should be constant in time, right?
There should be, yeah, after I've switched it off. Yes, I mean...
So what I'm trying to say is that, like, the CNs there will be different than the CNs we used first.
Yes.
It will be constant in time, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, likely.
As long as the potential is switched on, they won't be constant. Yeah, here, they have been switched off. So this will be a constant, but it'll be the last. Oh, maybe I can write it as,
okay,
does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does
it's
that
like
make sense?
CNTF
okay.
Minus
okay,
TF.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, this makes much sense.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So whatever the last, like at TF, whatever the coefficients were. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And for
the previous
our-
one made more sense, right?
No. Because you have switched off the potential, so there's no time dependence now.
But it means that zero is some coefficients, and those coefficients will stabilize after some time, no?
Exactly, like...
But not abruptly.
Not abruptly, it depends on the potential you're applying. It could be abruptly as well. We'll do an example.
Stop the potential abruptly.
It depends on how you're applying the potential, that's why. If it's an abrupt, it'll be abrupt change. If it's not, so
depends
think
on,
for
okay.
think. It depends on the potential, but think of the same atomic example. So you have atom, let's say it's in ground state. You apply electric field, what do you expect? You expect the transition probabilities to change, right? You expect the CN to change. Switch off the electric field. Ideally, it should remain on that state, but due to the facts which we talked yesterday, it decays. But the transition probabilities, they change. So the coefficients, they change after you apply the electric field. Is that clear?
Well, actually, no. Because I agree with what you said right now. If the CN of TF stays the same, then they will always stay in the ground state because they won't decay after that.
But it doesn't happen. Yesterday, remember, we said that they should decay because they interact with the... We are not looking... So this is not the entire system. The system is the system and the environment. So if I solve the Schrodinger equation for system and environment...
Then you will see the...
Yeah. That's what exactly we talked about yesterday.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
In the second line, should there be also a H naught plus V in the exponent?
The effect of potential has been taken into account by CN. So what the time-dependent potential is doing, it's changing the transition probabilities. It's not changing the bases. The phases are due to this. And we'll see this mathematically as well. How?
So we are keeping the basis and just...
Okay. We are keeping the basis for ease because we can't have a time-dependent basis. It's difficult to solve for a time-dependent basis. Yeah?
Just a quick comment. After TF, the exponential should be like T minus TF because it starts like evolving from TF with respect to H0.
Oh, so here?
Yeah, I think there should be a minus T.
TI minus TF, yeah. So I'm just taking T as a variable here, but that's a good observation, a minor one.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Anyways, so this is the picture we have. Now, if you see, you have a fast-moving phase changing with your system, right? It's difficult to solve still. So what we are going to do is, we are going to hop on the system H naught. So this visualize it something like rotating with H naught. So I'll hop on a system of H naught which is rotating. So to me, it would look stationary. And I'll just solve for this part of the wave function. This is interaction picture. It's like something is rotating like this. You apply an operator which rotates in the opposite direction. What do you see? You don't see the effect of this part. You don't see the effect of H naught. That's the interaction picture. Okay, yeah.
I didn't understand. Why do you need this global phase for the third segment, but not for the second segment? Like, why don't you have a T minus T naught in the middle section?
Exactly what I said, that you'll have some different T dependence. I'm just writing it as T. Is that what your question is? Like, for the third segment here, are you talking about this? I'm just taking T as some variable between T naught minus T or something. Is that what you're asking?
So why include this extra phase factor in the third section, not the second section? Like you wrote it differently. You wrote it.
It should be in the second section as well, but she's writing it all.
Yeah, I'm just writing it as HT naught by H cross. That's all. And then you can substitute T depending on from where to where you saw the evolution.
Well, we use the same time parameter in all three sections, right?
Yes, yes.
So there shouldn't...
But it depends on what time you're observing your system. So this should finally be the time when you're observing the system. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So I'm taking it as a variable T, but depending on what time you see, you'll just substitute it there.
So there's no extra phase factor
now? No, there's no extra phase factor now. It's just the time you're observing the system. Was that?
But it should be the time since the end of the T0 phase. It should be the time after T0. So it's T minus T0, which is the time during which the interaction, the V of T is happening.
Oh, so are you, is it related to this point? I can because connect both. And if that's a really good point. Since I just said that you're kind of changing your frame of references, then yes, your, I would say, the potential which you have applied will give an extra phase vector as well, because your V is not the same as it was in the lab frame. Is this you're trying to connect to? Because I can, yeah.
No, it's. I think it's not related. What you're saying comes like it's like the next step in the interaction picture. What I'm saying like works in this like shorter picture. Like,
okay.
Yeah, I think what he's saying is just that in the last step for t greater than tf, if you just substitute t equals tf, then that what comes outside the summation, the e power, that part, that has to become 1 or unity, right?
Why?
Because
it's right after.
It's right after you switch off the perturbation. So it should be the state that's at the end, at tf, and it shouldn't have any, like, in this expression, if you put in tf, it's different from, it's like the coefficients at tf and then an additional action of the
Hamiltonian H0. But
yeah,
tf is like fixed. It's still evolving with the H0.
Yeah, but
so why tf?
Equals tf. There has been no evolution yet due to H0.
But we are seeing for time beyond tf. So
right.
The system should evolve with T as well after TF,
yeah,
right?
I just think it's a.
I think it's.
Something anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Can we discuss about this?
Yeah.
It might be a something interesting point which I'm missing, but can we move ahead?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So let's try to solve this, and what we are going to do is we are going to use a different frame of reference which rotates in the opposite direction as compared to H0. So this is a phase vector which we are going to introduce in our psi, which we'll call as the interaction picture psi, okay? All right? But while we do that, of course, our potential should appear different as well, right? So this is my potential in my lab frame or the Schrodinger frame. Now, if I hop on a frame of reference which is rotating with e to the I h naught t, obviously my V should be affected as well. So let's see how V should evolve with time, okay? It's a bit of mathematics involved. Let's do that. So I'm using a new psi here, which is rotated by some vector, and this rotation is exactly opposite to the effect of H0. And I'm using S here, which is the same psi. It's in the Schrodinger or in the lab frame, okay? My aim is to find, to solve this equation, something like that, okay? Let's take a derivative. Because I want to see how it changes with time. Okay, and I know that so the whole purpose of doing this is I need a equation of motion for my new wave function. So I'm just trying to bring psi I somehow in this picture, okay? Using Heisenberg equation of motion for psi and S. And again, I can switch the frame and write it as gives me a equation for psi I. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think on that third line, it should be minus IH bar.
Minus?
IH bar just in front of R, since we take it from.
Okay, I can cross check. Maybe there's a typo in my, I don't know. But the final equation should look like this, I'm sure. Do you get a minus as well, everyone here? My note says.
I mean, we take it from the Schrodinger equation. Right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just like to send the AI.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. I can correct that. So there are so many typos in my notes. That's why I was hesitant to submit it on the SciPortal. Okay. But now I can just.
It's okay.
So R is your E to I phi. So R is just a rotation. And if I substitute it here, to me, these things don't matter much. I mean, I was talking yesterday to, I think, Thiago. I'm more interested in the physics than in the math. And constants and signs, they are important, I won't say. They are not when you are looking at the final result. But you're just trying to understand physics. It's like, okay, some constants. Yeah?
No, I answered it.
Okay, great. And this would be it. And I think this and this is going to cancel out. What you're going to left with is something really interesting. Where VI is and or maybe we were using R. Yeah. All right. So this is exactly the interaction picture where we now trying to solve an equation of motion for my new size, which are the size in my new frame of reference. But since I changed my reference, my potential should also have some effect of that rotation, which I did. And the effect is here. So as you can see, my new psi, new state, the evolution is being governed by Vi. And this Vi, the evolution has been governed by the Heisenberg picture. That's why it's usually called a combination of Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture. OK? This is a Schrodinger equation, this is a Heisenberg way of saying how the operators, they evolve, or the potential should evolve, right? OK, so let's see. This is not useful, right? This is the rotated frame of reference I. So we have to switch it back. And that's easy to do. So in my lab frame, should be just rotating it back. OK, that's how I get the lab of frame psi. What I'm more interested in this equation, because now I have a psi which has a fixed basis, and I can solve this equation now. So remember that psi I has a fixed basis in the sense at any time t. I can solve for these coefficients cn's. So that's why in interaction picture, we talk about time evolution of these coefficients. We talk about the time evolution of the probabilities of transitions, okay? How different states are being occupied when you have a time-dependent potential, all right? So we won't talk about size, but more or less it's like finding evolution of your psi, okay? But we are going to talk about this equation and how to solve it, the methods to do that, yeah.
And this last line on the slide, on the screen, what pictures the V of t on the right-hand side supposed to be in?
So this is the lab frame, the potential which I applied actually in lab, like a magnetic field or something. And this is the potential, mathematically, how it's going to look to me if I rotated my frame of reference in the opposite, like e to the power I h naught t. So if I rotated my frame, I do have a picture. Can I show that? Would that be more okay? Yeah.
Over the when you did in the last line.
Yeah.
On the top board on the last line.
Yeah.
Top no the top one board, yeah.
Oh, this so one.
You have a term that's e to the I h t over h bar, and then. So I understood that you cancelled that term with the first one.
Yeah, this term, yeah.
How do you know that the, oh, okay, they commute, right?
What commute? Oh, this is the same h naught. Oh, you mean at different times? This is not a time-dependent h naught, so it should commute.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's time-independent. That's the first assumption that we made, that we should be able to write our time-dependent Hamiltonian as sum of a time independent and a time dependent. So H naught is time independent.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't resolve my question. Yeah. So this V is an operator, right? Like I understand that it's the part of the potential, but it's an operator.
This one.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's an operator. Is it in the Schrodinger picture or the Heisenberg picture?
This is in the Schrodinger picture, the one which you're applying in the lab frame. So that's the Schrodinger picture operator, yes.
So when you're getting the time evolution of the interaction picture operator on the left-hand side, why is there time evolution coming from these extra factors, the exponentials, and from the Schrodinger picture? Shouldn't it be the Heisenberg picture operator in there?
Yeah, intuitively thinking, yes, but it doesn't. Why? Because just to think of the problem, if you have a rotating sphere, which is rotating with, like in clockwise direction with some frequency. It has some operator. I don't know how to represent that operator on the sphere, but let's say it has some potential. Now, if you are sitting on the sphere, which is rotating, that potential would look different to you. That's the potential which you are feeling when you are on the rotating sphere. So it should change. It shouldn't remain same, and it should change with these. The omega frequency, which with the sphere is rotating. Does that make sense?
Maybe I just need to think for a second.
Okay. I can show something very quickly, which I wanted to not show and skip. But this is the picture. Like I, because there was no mathematical details, and yesterday I got feedbacks that I shouldn't flash slides which have no mathematical details, but just to give you a visualization, this is, let's say, a magnetic field in z direction. A spin is going to rotate like this, okay? Now, if I apply time-dependent magnetic field additional, like Vt, which is on xy plane, which is rotating on the xy plane with the same frequency as the Larmor's frequency, I can simplify this picture by rotating my frame of reference in the opposite direction. and it'll simplify the picture a lot. Something of that sort, okay? So, but we can talk about this more if you like, if you still can't visualize it, okay?
I don't want to waste too much time, but could you go back to the last slide for just a moment?
Yeah, okay. This one, or?
Before that. Just because, so the, I know operators in the interaction picture are supposed to evolve only by the original Hamiltonian and H naught. It's supposed to govern their time evolution. And the states in the interaction picture evolve according to the interacting part of the Hamiltonian. So if you have these exponentials with H naught and a Schrodinger picture BT that evolves according to the interacting part, now the interacting operator is evolving according to the full Hamiltonian, which is certainly not correct.
For Schrodinger picture, these are not evolving, right? I'm confused.
Implicit time dependence.
Yeah, there's this time dependence is the implicit, like.
No, it's not. It's like external. It depends on how you're changing the magnetic field. It's not the same equation of motion of the Hamiltonian.
Okay, it's okay.
Okay, yeah, we can talk about this. I need to, I guess, I'm too slow with today's lecture, I guess. How many of you are finding it's too slow? And you have to be fair. Not much, or maybe some are being just polite. All right, okay. So let's, but it's good there are questions, and let's move ahead. I don't want to discourage you from asking questions just because I'm getting slow. That's okay. Write your questions in email. I'll really be happy to write a short description of. Okay, I can do that. It's no issue. It's no problem. Okay, so we are going to solve this equation of motion for CN, and the way we are going to do is by taking inner product with psi n. This is something standard. I will rush a little bit if you don't mind, and if at any point you see I'm missing a lot of details, just let me know. Because I think this is just trivial mathematics. So I'll write the first step and a few intermediate steps, which I think are important. Okay, and you know how to do the inner product and stuff. What you'll get is something like this. This is a kind of a matrix element for any kind of system, which sees how N and M are coupled to each other, okay? So, and this is an interaction picture. I can write it in my lap frame or Schrodinger picture, which should look like this. And I can write this in a short form. What is this? This is just a system of coupled first order differential equations. So I have a differential equation for each of the mth state in the system. So if I have a two-level system, there are two coupled equations. If a three-level system, three coupled equations, and so on. And that's a fancy way of writing it in matrices, but this gives you n equations for a n-level system. Okay, there are two ways to solve it. One is exactly free to do, but hard. Like if you have an atomic system, it will be really, really hard to solve this exactly because you have like a very long basis for it. So the number of equations would be so many. We always choose to do it perturbatively if our potential is very small. But let's see two examples. where we are going to first solve it exactly. So we'll simplify and just take a two-level system. And for a more complicated, like an n-level system, we'll do it perturbatively, okay? So let's first define what we are doing here. So I have a sudden violent perturbation. What does that mean? It means that the perturbation is constant. It's not varying with time. It could be varying with other parameters. And if it's a constant perturbation, you don't expect anything to happen to the system, right? It shouldn't be able to give any energy to the atomic system. But the catch here is that this perturbation is very violent. It is strong. So I can, let's say, apply the perturbation theory. These alphas are strong. And it is applied only for a time t is equal to 0, like faster than this. Okay, so there's a delta function. And what does it do? It causes transition between level 1 and 2. Okay, so this is the form of the potential. All right? This thing fine? All right. So, and this star here just signifies that alpha could be a complex number or a real number, whatever. So, what I want to do is I want to use this V in here and solve my differential equation. Okay. So, let's do it exactly. So, at the boundary conditions are that at time t just before, the perturbation was switched on. My system was in the ground state. And I want to see that after the perturbation is switched off, like it's just applied and off, how would these transition probabilities look like? Okay. So the two couple equations from here, which we need to solve. Said that the perturbation is only capable of making the transitions, so these two elements should be zero, right? That's the form of the potential. So my diagonal elements for these are zero. I know that it couldn't keep the state in the same state. It should, if it's applied, it should change the state of the system, all right?
Yeah, why is omega 1, 2,
minus? Because in here, you'll have E2 minus E1. So I'm just, so omega 1, 2, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just skipping so many details. I'm really sorry, yeah. Okay, so. Can I use this part of the board, you know? Have you seen anyone doing that? No? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace these other values. So instead of V12 and V21, I'll just write the potential's value. This is it. So these are the two equations which I want to solve. And this function here is a singular function, right? I cannot solve it. Any suggestions, how can I solve this? There's like a potential, there's a function at one point, one singular point. And yeah.
We can like have a step function on Zs.
Exactly, we can regulate the function instead, right? A function with a width or something. Is that right? Do you want a constant, like a step throughout? That would be a constant potential, exactly. But I want something like to be quick. So this is like really, really fast. I can regulate it by changing it to something like having a finite width. Like this doesn't have any width, it's just a spike, right? But if I choose a step function, it would mean I'm choosing a constant potential for a longer period of time, which is not the actual definition of my potential. Yeah.
I was thinking about the solution of having like a step, like a derivative, and I get the delta on the right side.
Oh, okay. So how do you find it? Like integrating it or something like
that? Because I have c dot, so if c has a step function in it, then it will give me a delta. When I,
this is not a continuous function, right? This is not a continuous function.
No.
I can't do that.
Well, but I can take a derivative of a step function to get a Dirac delta.
Oh, yeah, yes, I think so. Yeah, it should work. Yeah, that's a nice way of doing that as well. I don't know if it's going to give the correct things in the end or not, but that's a good thing to try. Yeah, yeah, I think it should. Yeah, that's interesting. So I'll just regulate it, and it's okay. In the end, what I'll say is that T naught is really, really small, and it aligns with the definition of my delta function, okay? So zero otherwise. But before doing that, what I want to do that is I want to get rid of these here, fast oscillating. And these are like continuous functions, right? So I can use this fact that should give me f of a, right? This is a property for continuous function. So if I use that at t is equal to 0, I can make my equations more simple. But I can't use this for my c2s because it's not a continuous function. I don't know what it should be at t. It's like a step function. Yeah?
Can you just integrate on both sides?
For integration, again, I would be integrating it for a time period, and I'll have problem integrating this part. It's not continuous, right? Unless I use the trick.
Oh, but then I would just use the definition of like integral of a Dirac delta. When you go over zero, you just...
I think that's what you were exactly talking about, right? Is that what you were also saying?
Yeah, you
kind of
using an NSATS approach, like supposing C1 is like proportional to a step function and then inputting this like form to find out what's the form exactly, like to figure out the rest of it. I'm talking about integrating both equations.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, yes.
This
they're coupled.
And
if they're coupled, I think in this particular case it works. It will just like flip C1 and C2, I think. It should work.
I don't know. I'm not sure it would work, but I tried integrating and finding. The problem I ran into was that in the end, it didn't give me physical solutions, and you can check maybe with your approach as well, that in the end, what I got was a time dependent, and the time dependent was not disappearing if I was switching off, like if my potential was not there, which didn't make sense. Because if my potential is like a spike, when it's not there, there should be no time dependence in my coefficients. And I was getting a time dependence in my coefficients. Maybe I was not using some mathematical trick or something, but that's the problem I ran into. So that's why I use a different approach of solving it. Okay. So I was getting like sine square t, and t was there even if I didn't have the potential, which didn't make sense to me. Like physically, the system shouldn't have a transition probability dependent on time if there's no time dependent potential. But with this, I found a solution for that. With this gave me a trick. Okay,
yes.
So this is a couple differential equation. Do you want me to do the steps? Can I just directly write the solutions? And you'll have the steps of how to solve couple differential equations in my notes. Does that sound okay? So what you'll have in the end is something like this. So what I just missed was some mathematical steps. That's it. So no need to worry about that. For this period of time. And it did make sense. Now, because after time t naught, my probabilities, they don't have any time dependence. So they are constant. And this gave me a better physical picture rather than solving them directly, like by integrating or. So this is at t is equal to t naught. And after t is equal to t naught, since there is no time dependent potential, my system should have these coefficients altogether. They should not change. Yeah.
To get the solution, should you take the limit of t0 goes to 0?
In here, yes. For this part, yes.
And this would give you an infinite argument.
To solve it? Oh, this. I'm sorry, this is not there.
Yeah, then just taking t0 to 0 would give you something diverging inside the cosine,
yes.
Inside the sine.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm just taking t not exactly 0, but yeah, approaching to 0. So it's be like, but to think of, these are like cos and sines, and they're always bounded. So if I take t0 not exactly 0, something, because in reality, whenever you're trying to have a sudden violent perturbation as well, like experimentally, you always have a very small period of time. It's not like exactly at zero, right? So even if this is like really small, the sine and cosines, these functions are bounded always. So your total probability would always be one, like sine square, cos square should give you one. Okay. We can have more discussions on this if you want, because that was the plan. And else I can move to the second example of how to do it perturbatively. Yeah.
So is the perturbative way to solve this equivalent to doing like a Dyson series?
Yes, exactly. So I'm just going to skip through the steps, but we'll do the example in detail, okay? So, exactly, we saw how to solve it. This was the solution, and if you saw, it's like oscillating with sine and cosine square, but only for the period of time when the perturbation is applied. Once you switch off the perturbation, there's no time dependence in your probabilities. So probabilities you'll get by taking mod square of this, if that's relevant. Okay. So the other way to solve problems, like you cannot solve n level system exactly, it's too difficult. So other way would be to treat it perturbatively, and we have already kind of done that using Dyson series. I'll just write two steps and then come to the example which I want to talk about, okay? So perturbative solution again demands solution of my differential equations for the coefficients. And the way would be the way we did for the Schrodinger picture. Remember the time-dependent Hamiltonian? We'll integrate it. substitute the limits, and the limits here, or the boundary condition, says that my system was initially in ith state. So at t is equal to 0, this gives me a delta function. And again, this Cm has a dependence on Cn, so I'll substitute it back, I'll get an n-fold integral, and so on and so forth. It'll be a series like this, which we have seen yesterday as well. And what this would mean, these are perturbative terms, first order in perturbation, second order in perturbation, and so on. And if your perturbation is small, you can, to a good approximation, just use first or second, all right? And the way to solve this is, again, this is a Dyson series, and these V's are already time ordered, so you don't have to worry about that, but you can uncouple these integrations using the trick which we did yesterday, okay? So for now, what we are going to do is we are going to just to solve one particular example up to first order, okay? We'll take a very small, like a weak perturbation, and solve this part. Okay, and see, try to see some physics. Do I have space there? So we'll do a constant perturbation example here, and I think I'll try to use slides more so that I don't have to write on the board. Okay, so this is the constant perturbation. It's only on for a period of time from T0 to TF, and it's zero otherwise, all right? And this is the coupled differential equation up to first order. If I solve it to first order, this coefficient is what I'm looking for. Yeah.
If I understood correctly, the previous problem wasn't really well posed, right? Because the, if the delta is a function, if you have the delta function, then you have a 1 over t0 thing there, right? So it might be better to think of it as like a barrier, like a square barrier or something.
Yes.
Like a finite square barrier.
But finite square, but very small width. Why? Because I didn't want these coefficients, but I could obviously use this. This would have an additional effect.
You got rid of them, okay.
Yes, I got rid of them. Theoretically, I'm. But experimentally, if you see, yes, there's no delta potential, like real quick potential. There's nothing like that in real terms. Yeah. Okay. So this is what I'm trying to see is I'm trying to find the probability that I'll find my system in some state F. So I'm trying to see the probability of transition from the ith state, which was the initial state. So Ci at t0 was 1. And the system was, like all other, was 0. So maybe I can write it. So if my state was in ith state, then the probability at t0 was 1, otherwise it was 0. So I'm trying to see that at time t, what would be the probability that I see my system in fth state? Yeah.
Sorry, I missed what delta mi is.
Oh, delta mi means that initially, so in an atomic system, I have levels and all my electrons in the ith state. So it's like, this is 1. The probability of finding my system is in the ith state is 1. And at t is equal to 0, when I start my experiment, the probability of finding the system in any other state is 0. So if m is not equal to I, you won't find the system in that state. That's what I mean by delta. OK, yeah. OK. And this is given by CF. And since I'm trying to find it to first order, I'll just take that integration. This is what I'm trying to solve, okay? Anything I missed here? Any point you would like to add? Okay. This is a standard integration, and if I solve it, what I get is the probability of transition or probability of me finding the system in fth state at time t would be just modulus square, and I can write it as 4 square goes away square. Okay, this is something which we are going to see behaves. This is almost all the math except for a few more mathematical things I want to do. Now, this is the probability of transition from ith to fth state. What parameters does it depend on? What does it depend on?
Energy separation.
It depends on the energy separation. And? It depends on the how strong the ith and fth states are coupled through the potential V, right? Because this is, and what's left?
That's it. Time.
Time. It depends on time. So let's see how it behaves with all these three, okay? This is something straightforward, which makes sense, that if your potential is coupling these two states strongly, you'll have more transition probability. Let's see with energy separation. And since it has a very tricky form, like there's an energy separation in denominator as well, we'll break my energy into two parts. One would be the energy conserving transitions, one would be energy non-conserving transitions, okay? So what I mean by energy non-conserving transition? Would mean my EF is not equal to EI. What's the probability that I'll find my state in F? So omega FI is not equal to zero. Okay, and don't worry, the total energy is conserved because you have a potential which is giving the energy to the transition, okay? And if you look at the formula, maybe I have it somewhere on my slides, yep, it's a much beautiful. So the relation is that it should oscillate with as a sine square function, right? Because time dependence is here. And if energy conserving transitions are small, with time, it should oscillate like a sine square. But doesn't make sense. If the energies are not same, how come a constant potential is able to give energy to the system that it transits to F? Which is right, because if you look at this coefficient here, the amplitude of transition, it's really, really small. So there is a chance that my state transits from I to F, even though the energies are not same, but that event of happening is really, really small. That's really small probability. And as you increase the energy differences, the probability of transition is like even lesser and lesser and lesser, which makes sense. Okay, let me show you how it looks like. Or maybe before that, for energy conserving transitions, how should it behave? So for energy conserving transition, I mean omega fi is zero. EF and EI are same. It doesn't mean that I and F are same. It's the energies, they are same, okay? They are like degenerate. How should it behave? So here it behaves like a sine square with time, with respect to time. How should it behave with respect to time if omega F approaches to zero? It's like a sine square x by x square, right?
It's constant.
Yeah. It should be like t square if I do all the math, because I have to make like t square here. So what it will look like is that my probability of this okay, we'll come to this, which physically is still not right, but I want to show you these graphs. Yeah. So this is my omega, the energy difference, omega fi. If it's small, if it's approaching zero, it behaves like a t square. So on the x-axis is the t. And as I increase omega, or the energy difference, you see, it shows me a sine square behavior. But the transition probability is decreasing in amplitude as I increase the energy difference. OK? And when I said that it doesn't make, still it doesn't make physical sense, do you know what I mean? The probabilities having a t square behavior.
Can it go beyond one?
It can go beyond one, and why do you say that?
Because it's like bounded.
Okay, and if I had a t, then would it be bounded?
I'm just saying that if you wait long enough, your probability is going to get like higher than one. So this makes no sense.
One of the reasons, but still I'm not satisfied. It's still, if it had a like t, which it should have, and I make t even longer, then it shouldn't be bounded, right? But this is a perturbative solution. This is not the entire picture, remember? We have to take into account the higher perturbations as well to have the exact actual time dependence. But that's not the point here. The point is, the probability is increasing t square, which means the rate is increasing linearly, right? Rate of transition would increase linearly with time, which is, to me, senseless. Why? Because rate means if I'm observing my, let's say, radioactive nuclei, the rate of transition or rate of decay would mean I see my nuclei now at t is equal to zero, it decays with some rate. If I see it at a later time, 10 seconds, the rate has increased. It shouldn't be dependent on time, right? But the time when I'm observing the decay should not depend if it has decayed or not.
But even if it, so you're saying that if it was linear, then it would make sense.
Yes.
But then still the probability of transition will increase with time. How does that, oh, okay. Even for a specific nucleus, the probability increases with time, or?
The probability will increase with time, but you cannot, there's a limit over like what time you're applying the perturbation for. If you apply the perturbation for a really long time, you might perturb your system. Your system is no longer you're studying for. So there's a limit you're applying the time, the perturbation for. There's a time limit. See, the probability should linearly increase with time, which makes sense. There's a nuclei. It hasn't decayed now. It hasn't decayed now. Now, as time increases, the probability of it increasing should increase. And it should increase linearly with time, not quadratically, because if it increases quadratically, the rate has a time dependence, which means that what time I'm observing, so rate is related to the probability per unit time, right? So probability per unit time is increasing with time, which should not be true for a real physical system. Okay? So it should have a linear dependence, not a quadratic one. And we can, I wanted to come and talk about the Fermi-Goldin rule. You know what we are missing, what we should incorporate when we are calculating these probabilities, which we have talked about yesterday, actually.
With the effect of the environment.
Yes, exactly. That they have a finite width. The levels, they are not sharp. They have a finite width because they are interacting with the environment, right? So we can maybe do it on Monday. All right, okay.